November 21st, 1980, California State University at Long Beach. Richard Wilde, interviewed by Kay Briegel.
Okay, eventually, Dr. Peterson was forced to resign. What did the faculty council do at that point?
Well, we had some interest in how the State Board of Education would go about selecting a successor. And I think people even attended the State Board meeting. I've forgotten who went. It seems to me Dave Dressler may have been there, and maybe Hugh Moorhead or somebody was there, and maybe George Corbin. And people did go, and They saw somebody with highly polished shoes who looked like he was a candidate, and they thought probably that was our new president. But I don't think they had, there was any way in which they had any input in the process. I think we tried to get it. I think we wrote to them. Whether we wrote as a faculty council or they wrote as AUP or in what format. And since you have these various organizations, you know, it could be, the efforts were made in various ways. But to my knowledge, we had no input in the hiring of President McIntosh at all.
When did you find out who the new president was going to be, or?
I don't really know. It was probably announced. As I said, we probably had rumors about it earlier, but at some point it was announced, and probably we didn't really know until it was announced.
Did you know anything about him before he came?
No, we didn't. We then tried to find out things about him. He came from Pocatello. We eventually tried to find out a little about his background, but I don't know how much success we had in that.
When did you first meet him?
I really don't know. I don't remember. I really don't remember.
What was going on in Long Beach in the interim while there was the summer? Where there was no president, or there was an
interim
president.
There was an interim president, and Magnuson was here.
Was he somebody, he wasn't somebody from the faculty then?
No. I don't know what kind of experience he had. He was an administrator, probably from the public school system, that had come up in the State Board of Education hierarchy somehow, and was down here to substitute, as I recall. I don't think he'd been a college president or anything like that.
Did he really do anything, or was he just kind of a caretaker?
No, I don't think any major policy decisions were made. People responded quite well to him. I think as I recall, people thought he was a pretty good fellow. And whatever problems there were, he seemed to solve in a fairly forthright way. Whatever dealings people had with him seemed to be rather straightforward. So people were kind of, pleased with his brief stay down here. But I really don't remember very much about the about where we met McIntosh, whether he was brought down and introduced to the faculty council or what happened. I really don't know.
Okay. Did Peterson make the final decisions about promotion and tenure and, hiring and things like that clear up until June when he left? Was it his decision that his decisions that were carried out beginning in the fall of 1960?
No, because once we had the faculty council, there was also a president's council. Administrators, and there were joint committees set up between these two bodies, and some of the earliest work of the faculty council was to set up machinery to handle promotion and hiring and distribution of vacant positions, and I was a member of several of those joint committees. They were called Joint Faculty Council, President's Council, Ad Hoc Committees. That was one on hiring policy, I see, looking at my vita sheet here, in 58-59, on allocation of new faculty positions, 59-60, And also apparently there was a committee on the faculty manual, so that a faculty committee became involved in the preparation of the faculty manual beginning in 58-59. We're interested in becoming involved in that as faculty because that was the vehicle by which many new things happened. Sometimes in the past, new curriculum would appear in the bulletin and new policies concerning the faculty would appear in the new faculty manual, which was published. It was written by Dave Bryant, I presume, and probably reflected whatever the deans and the president had talked to, President Peterson had talked about in terms of change or improvement or whatever they wanted to achieve. So rather than simply have policies affecting the faculty appear in that format, the faculty council at an early point wanted to get involved in the control of the faculty manual, or at least the participation of the faculty manual. I don't remember, but I presume we worked with Bryant on the manual. I don't remember who was on the committee with me, though. I think it may have been Carver and Metzger. At least at some point we were together on a committee on the faculty manual. And these committees on the faculty manual continued on into the time when McIntosh arrived, and I remember working with him directly on one occasion on the faculty manual. I think I must have been chairman of the committee because I remember having a conference with him about controversial matters in the manual and reaching some sort of compromise wording on things that were at a point of disagreement. So, besides having the faculty council, there was an effort to set up these things. We set up grievance procedures. One of the things that President McIntosh insisted on early when he came was that we set up a system for by which curriculum change would be processed by the faculty council. And at that time, a series of documents were drawn up showing how you originate curricular changes, how you get clearances from various intermediary bodies, and how ultimately it comes to the faculty council and receives approval and then presumably enters into the official bulletin. I remember participating in that, but I don't seem to have been on, according to my own records at least, I don't seem to have been on any special committee about it. I remember helping to draft some of the various mechanisms by which that was to be achieved. The faculty council thought that this was a kind of a job which should have been put off on a college curriculum committee and not involve the council directly, but President McIntosh insisted we become involved. So we eventually drafted machinery for doing that. But I remember that was one of the earliest things we did.
I want to go back to 1958-59 just for a little bit. These committees were in place and they were functioning, apparently, while Dr. Peterson was still here. Did he go along with them? With your decisions, did he actually negotiate with these committees? Because apparently that's something he hadn't been willing to do before. To actually participate in?
I don't recall negotiating with him directly, though he may have been at some of these joint meetings we held, but I don't recall negotiating with him directly. I recall negotiating with Dean Bryant and Dean Rhodes and so on, and Bratton and others who spoke for him. I think he sent other people to do the actual negotiating. I know the document was in final form, he didn't approve or indicate disapproval. But I think he worked more indirectly, but I'm not entirely sure if that's true, but that seems to be what I remember.
Did he concur with or approve the things that...
Oh, yes. Yes, he went along with them if they were agreed to by his president's council, and I guess he went along with them. So these things became official policy by joint agreement. When it came time to publish the faculty constitution, for example, the constitution for the faculty council, apparently there had been this steering committee, which preceded the faculty council, which he negotiated with the administration on the council document. The president alleged for a time that it had to be approved by Roy Simpson and the State Board of Education. And they eventually signed off, and we got into a lot of direct interaction, complaining that the president was in fact delaying and implementing this on the excuse that they had to approve. And eventually, I think Dr. Simpson simply wrote and said, "It's the president's responsibility, it's a local responsibility." And at that point, the president made peace with the steering committee, and it was agreed that he would publish the constitution to the faculty, the announcement of the faculty council, and so on. And the committee drafted his letter to the faculty, and he eventually sent it out over his signature, at least with his name on it, as the from party to the faculty. So that ultimately, I think these things were implemented. I probably could find in the archives and materials that I have documents which might confirm this process or make it a little more explicit.
Yeah, it's in those minutes that you
gave me. Is it in the minutes of the faculty council?
Yeah, about the thing about Dr. Simpson saying it's a local matter and Peterson saying it has to be
on it. I didn't realize where all this was. But anyway, so eventually we got a body of documents. We had a faculty council constitution. We had a document on RTA&T, as we called it. We had a document on hiring policy and allocation of openings. And we also drafted, by mutual consent, a faculty manual. We also had created, as part of the constitution of the faculty council, a body called a committee on committees. This was an idea we got as a faculty talking to San Diego State, and they said, if you allow the administration to appoint committees or don't have a well-structured system by which you place people on committees, you won't be able to manage the affairs of the university from a faculty point of view very successfully. So we set up a committee on committees, and I was apparently on the first three of those, beginning in 1958-59, and was later on the committee on committees again. The committee on committees, as I recall, very early decided that there would be a few critical things that the faculty would be interested in the first year after the Constitution. One of the critical areas would be the budget, and they created a budget and planning committee. And on that budget and planning committee were put four, five, six fairly strong and active people. Committee believed that these people would be able to penetrate the budget and find out how the university worked and where the money came from and where it went and how it got there. And it turned out I became chairman of that committee. And it was a very active committee. And it worked very closely with President McIntosh. During the year I was chairman of the committee, I think I was the first chairman of that committee.
And so in 58-59, then these things hadn't evolved. 58-59.
I think the committee structure began functioning in 60-61. At least that's the first year we had a budget and planning committee. I'm sure I was the first chairman of that committee.
But the retirement, tenure, and advancement, must have started earlier, or I mean
that could be, because that was negotiated by the steering that was a joint faculty council president's council activity. It was apparently negotiated during 59-60, according to if my records are correct, and probably came into force in 60-61. My guess is a lot of these things may have come into force in 60-61, actually.
So that you weren't able to actually implement them, even though you had the faculty council and the constitution and the plans for these things by 58.
I don't really know what happened during the promotion year of 59-60. Promotions were normally handled late in the year. It might be that the process was originally, was applicable. I don't know. You have to see the date on the document and try to determine when these decisions were made. But normally they were made fairly late in the year. They tend to get announced in the summertime. So if the document was ready for use and a committee was elected, as it could have been in 59, in the spring of 1960, then the promotions for that year, 59-60, would have been under the committee. But I don't remember that without looking up the documents. It's probably something that one could find out.
But that's after McIntosh was already here. He came in the fall of 59.
Well, if he came in the fall of 59, yeah, then it would be after he was here. Yeah.
Okay.
It seems to me, I have here, though, that the Committee on Allocation of New Faculty Positions was 59-60.
So that would have been his first year.
Yeah, but I remember that as something we looked with Bryant and others on, rather than with McIntosh.
Well, maybe it was set up and...
I don't know. It would really take some work to find out exactly... what occurred under Peterson and what began under McIntosh. I remember McIntosh's first year being 60-61, but obviously my memory is wrong on that. I must have been here earlier. But I thought the Budget Committee was doing its first year here, but apparently it wasn't.
Well, I guess it took time to set things up.
Yeah, there must have been some time. Well, the Faculty Council came into being in... its minutes begin 58, don't they? So it came into being fairly quickly. I guess that promotions being a critical issue, I see we had one on hiring policy in 58-59. Maybe that's the one I remember working with Brian and which President Peterson was involved in.
Do you remember if it made any difference in the history department after that committee was set up?
Well, we weren't departments yet.
Well, within the social science division.
Yes, I think so. I think the division chairman came to have a bigger role in hiring, and that they worked then with the faculties of their divisions, and these may have, conditions may have varied from division to division. I don't recall whether the history faculty formed a committee for hiring historians and the geography faculty for hiring geographers. That eventually happened, but whether that happened as early as 59 or whether it happened later, I don't know. President McIntosh would not have been, the notion that he would have hired faculty without consulting, the academic departments, it simply wasn't a part of his style. He's been a university president. He knew normally he knew his consultation. So I don't think there was really any problem in him. When we negotiated that document, of course, we thought that we were still in the beginning with Peterson, so we'd done a hiring on a very individual basis.
Yeah, I guess
he may have consulted the division chairman. How much he consulted them, I don't really know.
Well, I was thinking about the last year that Peterson was here, and apparently he didn't consult with the history faculty, even though he was under pressure to...
I don't really know whether he hired historians in that year or not. I don't recall any particular conflict about the hiring of somebody, it may have happened. You have to look at when people were hired to see if anybody was hired in history that particular year. Because you didn't hire somebody in history every year. Not then, but ultimately, for a long period of time.
But, well, apparently after you were hired, though, there was at least some consultation on not hiring two British historians in the same year when the college wasn't growing that rapidly.
Let's see, who was the next person there? Was it Don Peters?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, I don't recall the history of people having any role in hiring Peters. I think he just arrived and we said hi and introduced each other. And he told us how he got roped in and we told him how we got hired. And that's how we got to know each other. Now, Peterson may have talked to Gregory about his hiring. Because that would have been a step in advance of where he was originally when he went out and did it all by himself in the early days.
Well, apparently by the time Ted Nichols was hired, somebody was listening a little bit because Dr. Alquist had been asking all along to hire for a Latin American.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that may very well be. And, of course, Dr. Alquist was not among the rebels and enemies of Peterson, and he may, even informally have been able to have some input in that sense.
Well, he points out that he was never on any of the committees that Dr. Peterson set up either. Even though he was not a rebel and enemy, he was not on the committee.
Well, I don't think Peterson trusted any social scientist very far. I don't think he thought we were basically a reliable lot.
But anyway, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that eventually people outside of British and United States history were hired.
That's right. They were, indeed. But that could have been because the division chairman was talked to and the division chairman talked to the faculty, and it could have been handled rather informally in that way. And I really don't remember how that may have gone way back then.
But it wasn't until McIntosh came that there was an organized effort to figure out who was needed in history, what field was needed in history, and then to look at people's papers in that field and try to get the best person.
I think that's true. As I said, I don't know how early the process began, but my guess is that's probably when it happened. I haven't looked at this document on hiring policy, which was drafted and agreed to back here in 58-59, to see what machinery it called for. But my guess is whatever the machinery was probably was being used.
Well, you said you were the first chairman of the history department.
I was.
When the department was set up.
That's right. That was in 61, too.
Yeah. Was there some kind of a process like that set up at that time?
Yes. There was an ongoing process then. Because I know that I wrote away to graduate schools, called graduate schools on the telephone, assembled large numbers of papers, submitted them to faculty for review. And, that was the year we hired, I think, Alan Brownsword, Joel Tarr, and Gene Asher. Well, maybe it was Erwin Unger, Joel Tarr, and Alan Brownsword, and Asher had been hired the year before.
Yeah,
I think that's probably
right. He says that he was perhaps the last person hired by Dr. Peterson.
Yeah, that could very well be. So he and Ted Nichols would have been hired earlier. But I think it was Unger, Tarr, and Brownsword, none of whom stayed, all of whom went on to bigger and better things in their view. But they were the people that were hired when I was chairman. Now, we may have hired others as well. But I recall that trio, at least, as being a part of the process. And even when I was chairman, I was part of the committee. I'm sure I was in on that. I remember that very distinctly.
In other words, there was a big change when McIntosh came. He expected, his expectations about how the college should run were very different.
Yes, I think he conceived of it more as a normal university. He conceived of it at least as a land-grant university, which would have applied practical and the normal run of liberal arts programs and be a comprehensive university. And I think he thought it would operate according to the general accepted rules of the university, which professionally, fairly well understood. So I don't think that He had differences with the faculty, but I don't think he had any difference ever about structure. And I was really impressed with the fact that he was willing to involve the faculty in budget. He opened the entire budget process to the committee of which I was chairman. As chairman of the committee, he took me with him to Sacramento along with the business manager, Barney Carmen. At the time, our budget was reviewed by the finance people in the State Department of Education, which is a kind of the process of which the budget was finalized and settled. All information was available to us. Anything I asked for, I was able to get. There was no difficulty about that. He threw the entire responsibility of reallocating such funds as we could redirect on the committee. At times he indicated that there were certain things he wouldn't approve, and other things that he said he really thought were unwise. But many of these he went along with if the committee insisted. So he was willing to extend to a budget committee, at least during the year I was chairman, far more involvement in budget than I think was normal on the campus. He gave me the impression he did this in part because he didn't have much confidence in the inherited deans from the Peterson administration, and that he realized that if he tried to rely on them, things would end up pretty much where they were, and if change was to be enacted, why, they would probably have to come from a different source. So he said, the reason faculty committees exist is to absorb part of the guff and part of the hostility that grows up when some people lose money while people get money. So he said, you're going to have to bear a lot of the responsibility and blame and all that.
Yeah.
So, maybe we just hit it off well, but I was really very surprised. It was an absolute revolution, and nothing I thought was conceivable in the old regime.
As a member of these committees and the faculty council, what was your relationship with those other deans? Because when the faculty called for a change, they didn't just call for the resignation of Peterson. They called for
That's
a resignation
right.
of all the major
That's
deans
right.
as well.
That's right.
And apparently, most of them stayed.
They did.
So what was the relationship between the people who had been in the revolution, so to speak, and the people who didn't get overthrown?
Well, I think there was a fair amount of distrust on both sides, and people tended to work together sort of at arm's length. But people varied a little bit in their personalities. There was more inclination to feel that Wes Bratton had been really a pretty good guy, and probably Rhodes and Bryant particularly were the people that had to be watched most carefully. Frenchie Flynn less so because he was in a different area planning. But when they survived, we had to work with them. There wasn't any option. And I didn't get the feeling in the case of working with Rhodes or working with Bryant that they were cooperating and participating, you know, because they believed in the process particularly. They'd been brought up in a different school, and I don't think they thought it was appropriate for me as a faculty member to be involved in some of the things I was doing at that time. I was a fairly young fellow, I probably didn't think I had much experience or knew what I was doing. Probably wasn't dry behind the ears yet in many ways, and indeed that one looked at some of the things we did, it may actually have been true that some things were pretty naive and reflected in experience. But my feeling was that if you pressed them into a corner, why, they would work along. President McIntosh indicated to me in certain areas that if I got obstruction from deans, well, he would override it. But once the committee and he had made decisions, they would be carried out, and nobody would be allowed to do anything with the team. In many ways, decisions were made about budgets in areas that were normally, Dean Rhodes in particular, would have had an intimate concern without really consulting him. In many ways, he was treated rather shabbily, if I reflect on it. But that's where it was.
What kind of changes did McIntosh make in the office, the president's office, or in the way he ran the president's office?
Well, I'm not tremendously aware of a lot of changes in the way he ran the office.
Well, I mean, he didn't...
He was accessible. When I was chair of the budget committee, I would sometimes see him several times a week. I mean, there was never a question of accessibility. He was always with views in town. He was available. So, I don't know if everybody experienced the same thing. Maybe he thought the budget was a particularly important matter to get sorted out and find out where the problems were.
And a lot of trouble. I mean, a whole lot of trouble. You can always fix your head that way.
Maybe he felt that, you know, we should iron out whatever problems we're going to get on a new basis, and that was that.
Since he couldn't rely on the people that Peterson had relied on, did he bring in other people to help him in the administration?
Well, eventually he brought in some people. He brought in Hayden Cox, who used to be in the area of research and worked with the foundation. I think he hired someone named like Rutherford who came in. Eventually, when he wanted to resign or retire, or what did he do? Well, anyway. Let's see. Well, eventually we got a dean of the college, and that was Ray Lindgren. He was hired, of course, by McIntosh. I've forgotten just what process led to that. Then when Lindgren resigned, there was a reorganization, and Simonson and Towner were brought into key positions. Towner took over an important area of allocation and business activity, and that was a change. Towner and Don Simonson were among the most active members of that famous budget committee we put together. The other members were Dean Vivian of Engineering. Barney Carmen and Frenchie Flynn, I think, remember. Maybe Frenchie Flynn and not Carmen. Maybe they were older equals on it. Hugh Moorhead was on it. Somebody else. But anyway, it's interesting that both Simonson and Towner went on to administrative. So did I, as a matter of fact, it turned out. Maybe we all had ambitions, or we all had talents, or we all had failures of character that led to this. I don't know. I remember that Towner and Simonson and I would spend hours together over budget tables and figures and statistics and allocation problems, putting together drafts and suggestions for the committee at a very early stage.
That's when you were all still faculty.
We were all still faculty members of the faculty of the budget committee that first year. So it was several years later then that both Simonson and Howard by that in the administration.
When Ray Lindman came and when Towner and Simonson went into the administration, did that help the relationship between the faculty and the administration?
I think so. We had a we had a kind of a confrontation between the faculty council and McIntosh over a disturbance in the school of business between Gregory and Metzger, which occurred when Ray Lindgren was dean of the college. And that led to a very bitter controversy, and I remember being in a state of confrontation with McIntosh on that particular issue. There was also the affair of Jimmy Noguer in foreign languages, and I don't remember as much about that. I wasn't as active in that matter.
Could you talk about the Metzger-Gregory case in a little more detail?
Well, I wish I remembered what year it is. I have materials on it at home. Is it 63?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I only know what I've been told, and it's all secondary. I have no firsthand knowledge, but Metzger and Gregory had been at swords points for some time in the area of management. I don't know exactly on what ground. And at some committee meeting in which they were both in attendance, they got into sort of a shouting match and may possibly have approached each other, and the allegation was that Metzger had knocked Gregory's glasses from his face and perhaps used strong language, that there was some sort of a physical confrontation and so on. And the then chairman or acting chairman or of the division of business was Austin Reed. And Austin Reed's report of this incident to Ray Lindgren apparently led Ray Lindgren to decide to suspend Metzger for unprofessional conduct, bring him to disciplinary action. President McIntosh supported that. And the faculty came to the support of Metzger, who'd been sympathetic and at least semi a part of all the movements from the very earliest days. When the days of confrontation with Peterson, he was sort of a double agent in the sense that apparently, well, maybe not a double agent, but he told a lot of faculty things that were going on in administration, which he had access to, which the rest of us did not. So while he wasn't perhaps on some of the activist committees, he was always considered a sort of a part of the faculty group in the early days. And so they sort of came to his support, and a fairly sharp confrontation occurred in which I became involved. The official view was that whatever the events, they weren't sufficiently serious to involve endangering a person's employment. Maybe reprimands or something else was in order, but not anything beyond that.
How was AAUP involved in
this? Well, AAUP would be involved in any case in which a faculty member was dismissed. AAUP, it lays down the standards for the profession on how faculty are dismissed on professional conduct and disciplinary action. So, Metzger had tenure, and it wasn't a question of a grant of tenure, which was the Martin Black thing, which is one stage of faculty involvement. But once a faculty member has tenure, then AAUP has very stringent rules which they lay down as to how hearings will be conducted and actions to be taken. And in this particular case, there was suspension of action before there was such a hearing. Apparently on the grounds that he had some dangerous person who had to be suspended, which was bit of an excessive view. Metzger admitted he was an ex-football player from Berkeley, and he's a formidable person physically, but Gregory's no small man. It was hard for any of us to believe that we had a process here of severe physical coercion. Well, the story is that Metzger and a friend by the name of Heinz went about as sort of a gang of two, and they sort of threw their weight around. And there were ways that a lot of people in business apparently didn't care much for. So there was some feeling against them, apparently. But I really, well, that's about what I remember of the affair. It was a fairly sharp confrontation with ultimately with the person McIntosh was supported by. Dean of the college Windman, and that's where all of it, they went to court, lots of other things. I guess he was suspended. He was off campus for a while. I don't know if he ever recovered the lost salary. I think he wouldn't.
But he got his job back.
Yeah, he was suspended for a period of time in the region.
Was this due to the relationship between the faculty council and McIntosh and Lindgren and what had been a cordial attitude, apparently?
Well, I think it was one of the things that made it hard for Lindgren to continue when the university was reorganized and a vice president for academic affairs was created and so on. It made it hard for him to succeed from the dean of the college to that position. And a lot of people felt very indebted to McIntosh in this matter. I thought McIntosh had made a mistake, but my experience with him had been that he was a reasonable man to work with on many things, and so I was willing to call it a mistake and not, you know, such a serious flaw of character that he had to be put in the pillory for 6 weeks or something for it. So, and you saw my friend, so I was lacked enthusiasm. I thought I was a little bit inclined to see perhaps good or potential good in McIntosh that someone was going to see. The Jerry O'Care affair excited me less. I never became directly involved. I don't know why. I wasn't on any committees or anything looking at it. But a lot of people felt very bitter about that.
Could you describe the details of what this is written?
Well, I don't know. It was a complex matter. He was the head of the foreign language department, and for one thing, there was a lot of conflict in foreign language. A lot of people thought he accused him of being very tyrannical and very personally vindictive towards them. So there was a lot of internal tension in foreign language. Enmities of that sort, which were fairly deep. I really don't know how the question arose as to whether or not he legitimately claimed to have a doctorate, and whether he'd written a legitimate doctoral dissertation. It seems to me he had a Spanish university degree, and this was not easy to sort out, and ultimately a lot of effort was made to sort that out. But I really wasn't directly involved in that very much. A lot of people feel very strongly on it, and did feel very strongly on that matter.
But he ultimately also stayed?
He ultimately stayed. Whether or not it was a promotion that was at stake or not, I don't know. It seems to me that we reached professorial rank, but I'm not sure. So he stayed on through the whole thing. He was on the, I was on the committee on committees with him, and he was a member of the faculty council. So, apparently, liked him. He was a very jovial, likable person, Jimmy O'Gara. He did a lot of things. But I don't know whether he. I never really had access to information to make an independent judgment on the point of controversy, let's put that way.
Okay, I'm also interested in the basic documents that, that the faculty council is essentially created to operate the college under that you talked about before. It seems kind of incredible to me that the college was 10 years old, more than 10 years old, by the time that you got around to publishing me.
Oh. Well, we had a faculty manual, of course, and that's what presumably governed the college up until, and that continued to be a document which summarized policy. You either incorporated or summarized whatever documents and policies were, you know, agreed to, beginning with the faculty council and some of these early documents I've talked about.
So the first basic document then would be the Constitution of the Faculty Council.
Yeah, I guess so. And then there'd be the IDMP document and the hiring policy document. And there were a whole series of documents handling derogatory.